Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 75, section 4, which is old single column, page 842. Okay, I think all we need to do to remind ourselves of where we left off in the preceding session is recall the final three-word sentence of the preceding section there. It was done. And what is it? Eve and Cano know each other in the biblical sense. That's where we left off. And recall that I was talking about the setting a bit, foreshadowing some things that they state directly in this next section. You know, they told us it was an autumn evening, and we were kind of getting the sense it was sort of this idyllic setting. Nothing was giving any hint of just what a cataclysmic event was about to transpire. But, remember, they also said there in the next to the last sentence, before she quite realized. And you can see the word realization again in the title of this section. Remember that in the Revelation, realization is not in the trivial sense that humans use it. What they mean by that is, like we stressed so much, there's this whole vast number of circumstances that all conspired together to pull Adam and Eve's consciousness more and more down. More and more material gravity is dragging their consciousness down. They're losing that precise immediacy of personality, engagement of oversight of the situation. But quickly, she snaps too. And more than just that objective recognition from that higher vantage point of your personal self, like if you think in the hourglass analogy, more than just the immediacy of beginning to get above your basic adjutant animal origin self in the lower domain, more than just that beginning recognition, but to take a hold of what's recognized with your personality. That's what you mean by realization. That gift from eternity can take a hold of that objective consciousness and see it clearly, with your feet firmly planted on eternity, instead of you temporarily being lost in the confusions of time. That to reality eyes, is to become real, is to engage eternity and infinity. Obviously not in some absolute direct conscious sense or anything, but right, but because of the grace and the gifts that we're given, that's effectively what's happening. You are firmly gripping that transcendent objective perspective, and not just recognizing but realizing the reality of what you're facing. Whereas before, you were lost in the appearance. Yeah. You had something that you wanted to bring in there?
Yeah, I want to ask a question. Mm-hmm. So, oftentimes you have sex and you don't get pregnant.
Yeah.
So, in this particular case, You know, I mean, it was done, and they had sex.
Yep.
And so it really wasn't so much the act that she got pregnant. It was the act of actually, you know, having sex with him was more the it was done versus, you know, she may or may not have gotten pregnant. After she did get pregnant, we know that, but I'm just wondering
if
you can comment on that.
We're going to get to that. That's coming right up. So let me not get totally ahead, but I'll just say right up front, even if she hadn't gotten pregnant, it still would have been a default.
Right. I mean, that's the issue.
Because, you know, and that's what we're about to get into in this next section. You know, it says, you know, we just talked about the realization, but what about that default word? You know, what is the technicality? So, you know, before I say anything else about that, let's just, let me play off of what they give us here as we get into the section a little bit. Okay, so, you know, we're immediately reminded, as you start out this first paragraph, what even as you're reading through the story, you tend to forget about. You know, you focus on Adam and Eve and how they're feeling more and more alone and isolated. But of course, you know, there's all of these celestial beings on the planet. I mean, a whole vast, you know, retinue of them came, you know, with them, you know, as part of this dispensation. And I mean, so there's all of the angels and all, I mean, there's probably all kinds of unrevealed beings and whatnot, you know, that are involved in these things. There's all these beings that are watching, you know, have been watching for 5 years now. Remember, this a whole thing building up, and so it is done. You know, it's not just Eve who can wake up? I mean, to this. I mean, it's everyone is right there.
Oops.
Right. Fully expecting that this is not going to end well. Okay. So let's see what they say here.
Section 4: The realization of default. The celestial life of the planet was astir. Adam recognized that something was wrong, and he asked Eve to come aside with him in the garden. And now, for the first time, Adam heard the entire story of the long-nourished plan for accelerating world improvement by operating simultaneously in two directions: the prosecution of the divine plan concomitantly with the execution of the Serpentatia enterprise.
Okay. So first thing to notice, and that for, I think it's in the second sentence, after they tell you that celestial life is astir, Adam recognized that something was wrong. Okay. So see, as soon as they talk about it, you know, again, not wrong like humans flippantly use it. It's, you know, I stress this all the time, but we want to, you know, when it's very critical, you know, notice that Salonia, the author, said wrong. Okay, and that Adam recognized that something was wrong. In other words, he recognized, remember, righteousness is conformity with the cosmos. Okay, he recognized that the synchronization with the whole, with the cosmos, technically through the individuality of the whole, right, through the mother, something had broken. You know, he could feel the lack of resonance with the universal harmony that is the cosmos. Something was wrong. Okay, and you know, we spent a lot of time last week, you know, thinking about this whole issue of how this could be that this, for the first time, right, he's being told about this. We don't need to rehash all of that again, but you know, you can see it very much stated directly there. And then notice the way they speak about, you know, as they begin to speak precisely about what the issue is. Okay, it's not that there's some transgression of taboo. You know, certainly in the sense that the first thing that humans will think about, like, oh, she had sex with someone who isn't her husband, you know, or, you know, it's like, you know, that's taboo. No, it has absolutely nothing to do with sex. The sex, whether she gets pregnant or not, it has nothing to do with any of that. It has nothing to do with the mores system, you know, let alone the taboos in the mores system. That's irrelevant. Okay? You know, they telling you that what she was trying to do was operate simultaneously in two directions. Remember, we stressed, right, that we could how significant the place direction differential is between an Eve and an Adam, respectively. Right, that you know, with humans, we you know, the males and females are have a bell curve distribution, right? The centers of which are separated direction place. But with an Adam and Eve, it's like the remote tails of the two distributions of humans. I mean, they're very definitively separated into she's place and he's direction, and they must work together in coordinated fashion. They really, you know, each just have one eye in a cosmic sense. Okay. So there's the direction that they've been assigned to follow. I mean, as material sons, you know, in the higher sense where they're both material sons, both implementers of direction, you know, they're supposed to be following that purposing, that directing influence. But, you know, in a very lowly way, you have this Nodite, Serapeutatia, right, a source of direction to her place that she, you know, coordinated with. So you have two directions. And it's like, well, okay, so what? Okay, so on the one hand, you can say there's Adam's direction, and on the other hand, you can say there's Serapeutatia's direction. How could that be some sort of cosmic cataclysm? If that's all it was, it wouldn't be, right? Me trying to follow two human directions is not some big issue, right? The big issue is that one of these directions isn't just a direction of some, you know, mortal or, you know, material creature. One of these directions is the way, right? Not a way, the way, right? You have a divine plan, right? Like they're saying there. The will, right, is the source of a divine plan. And that's implemented, right? The Father's will is implemented as a literal fact, Mother Deity, the way. The way is, you know, that inherent evolutionary systemic directionality in the cosmos, of the cosmos. Okay? The way. So, you know, the very fact that, you know, the Urantia book tells you that what the definition of righteousness is conformity with the cosmos. Not conformity with the Mori system, not conformity, you know, with the existential father, even. Conformity with the cosmos, the way, the mother, right? Experiential deity in time and space. The will made way. Okay, that's the issue. It's what we see all the time. It's what we saw with the rebellion. Why did, you know, so many of the prince's staff, why couldn't they get it? Why couldn't they see that things were off the rails with Caligastia? Because they didn't have enough objective relationship to the other parent, to the mother. And they couldn't discriminate between a way and the way. So that's what fundamentally is in play here.
Is that why Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth"?
When
you keep saying that, it came up in my mind.
Right, and why does he say that? You know, especially when you think, you know, and you begin to understand the fifth epical revelation, and you think, well, in the seventh bestowal, isn't he really trying to express the will of the Father? You know, even if it's technically the will of the first master spirit, you know, but the will of the Father. So, you know, why does he say I'm the way? Well, it becomes clear when you reflect on, you know, he's going to give us this immediacy of being able to synchronize with this way he's talking about, the spirit of truth. Right? And truth is not, doesn't embody the essence of a part, even the part, the universal Father. Right? It embodies the essence of the whole. Right? And just think about the very fact that he can't minister that to you himself. He hands off that spiritual flavoring, if you will, that spiritual ministry, that spiritual signal to the local universe Mother Spirit. She's the one that's directly, you know, giving you that relationship to the whole, because she's the local individuality of the whole, not the Creator Son, even as a Master Son. That's the fundamental distinction. You know, we're right back to it again, as so often, between the first four epical revelations and the fifth. Yes, it's the fifth epical revelation of God the Father, but it's the first epical revelation of God the Mother. It's the first epical revelation of how you have some relationship to God the Father that isn't magical. How the universe is logical. How there's a physics to everything. There's no magic. What's the way I get to the Father? Do I have a mystic, magical connection to the Father like we've always thought? No. Right? There has to be some literal means. And, it's that synchronization of your mind to the cosmos, to the mother deity behind that cosmos, whether it's the local expression of mother deity or if it's the universal mother of the whole grand universe, that's how you keep a hold of the big picture. That's how you don't end up, unfortunately, using the gift that the Father gave you to purpose your mindal self in the opposite direction that it should be purposed in, so that instead of going to eternity, you go to oblivion. Right? There's nothing natural about going to oblivion. You have to use your personality to go to iniquity. And you have to use it wholeheartedly, right? And to the nth degree. It's a very unnatural thing to happen. You only do that when you forget that there's two parents you have to synchronize with. And you can't just take on the tunnel vision of the Father, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. I'm just going to will my way to whatever. You're a member of a cosmic system. You have to synchronize with that cosmic system. Not only to get to the Isle of Paradise, but to not end up doing things like Eve did. Which again, remember, the whole point of reading this is not just to get the history, and to get some insight. Oh, that's where that line in the, in Genesis, third chapter of Genesis came from or whatever. Right? But it's so relevant to us. Right? You're going to follow the exact same pathology if you don't take delight in cultivating having both eyes open, so that you have cosmic depth of perspective. Yeah, you got something?
Just about the mores, mm-hmm. You were saying it doesn't have to do with that.
Yeah.
But I was thinking the mother's way in her holistic wholeness, mm-hmm. has like a flavor of legitimacy to the mores are part of it. So there is something real about the mores.
Yeah, the way that works with the mores is, remember, humans haven't figured out what the word moral means yet, and the revelation is trying to help us with that. Technically, it's this synchron, relating, you know, speaking to this synchronization with the cosmos, you know, your moral duty is your duty to the cosmos, for instance. And we have, by grace, we all are encircled in the Holy Spirit. We all have a super conscious moral discrimination, you know, the second cosmic intuition giving you that initial insight into that. There's genuine morality superconsciously in every child of God. But that casts a shadow down into the consciousness, you know, as a sort of an uneasy feeling where you're groping around in the dark trying to have something definitive that you're going to use this word moral for that's filtered down into your consciousness. You know there's this fact, but you're not told what you're supposed to stick that label on. You know, the mores system, you know, is each generation's attempt to try to consciousize this inclination that they feel to speak of right and wrong. Okay? And as the Revelators, tell you over and over again as they go through history, you know, the mores system is here, there, and everywhere. You know, it's 180 degrees, we've had everything under the sun is what we thought was right and wrong over the generations. Exact opposite things, go from right to wrong. Kind of to the spirit of what you're saying, if you can recognize, if you can use your insight and objectively recognize that someone is sincerely attempting to give conscious clarity to this intuition about right and wrong, then you could speak of that mores system as morality, sort of, kind of, quote unquote, right? But the fifth epical revelation, again, is trying to say, okay, but it's time that you started abstracting, this not yet recognized objective fact of morality from the vagueness of the mores system. You know, and certainly when you start to think about sin, and I'm about to get to that, sin is not transgression of taboo. It's not the transgression of the thou shalt nots in the mores system. Sin has nothing to do with that.
But one more thing about, as a citizen, even though we have immature mores, you don't want to, totally go against what...
Yeah, great point. Yeah, before I leave it, let's just stress... Exactly, let's stress this. I mean, Jesus gives, the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it, right? I mean, they tell you that's significant. I mean, he didn't just... turn his back on the mores system of his day, right? He respected it because there's a divinity in that in an evolutionary sense, right? So that's the challenge. And another challenge of the fifth epical revelation is you begin to recognize that there's a difference between conforming to the cosmos and conforming to the mores system. That doesn't mean that you just forget about the mores system. You have to serve two masters, right? In your outer life, you give respect to the mores system of your day. Nothing else, you'd like to be able to move up the hierarchy and get to love. You can't get there if you're not first just, law-abiding and honest, conforming in the outer life to the mores system. But there's an inner life that humans have never really discovered yet, right? Where there's that conscious awareness of that word, what that word moral actually is applied to. And you need to manifest a loyalty to both, right? A conformity to the cosmos within, and a conformity to the evolutionary state, that you're born into without, and find the wisdom to not have those be at endless odds with each other. There's the tricky part. how do you resolve that tension between those two? You know, the fact that your outer life is not being lived in Havona. If it was being lived in Havona, there's no contrast between the inner life and the outer life. But here, there's almost nothing but contrast. Right? And so how do you not have that contrast tear you apart? But anyway, you can see just between the lines is this whole fifth epical awakening to the cosmos and your conformity to it, your relationship to it, your duty to it, your responsibility to it, you know, all these issues. Like they say, I mean, when it boils down to the rebellion, sure, okay, there's the spirit fact liberty, but does it conform, does your individual liberty conform to the cosmic system or not? It's like, well, who cares? Liberty is liberty. I exist existentially. No, you know, that's not the way it works. You gotta have that individual inner life liberty conforming with the cosmos. Is it true or false liberty? That's what it boils down to. You know, it's not just, well, there's liberty and then it's innately true. No, you have the Father is, you know, basically giving you, initiating the liberty. There's another parent that sees to that modifier before liberty, right? Are you conforming to the other parent so that it's true liberty, or are you just conforming to yourself? Is it self-righteousness? Is it false liberty?
Does liberty have anything to do with will?
I mean, it has to do with your genuine personal self of spiritualized mind. It's about that inner life domain that the word liberty technically is applied. When you downstep that and express it outward, then you use the word freedom. Freedom is about sort of a, you know, the application of that individual inner spiritual liberty to the material facts of your outer life. Okay. So a lot, you know, a lot there, but it's important because it's unless you really stress this, it all seems so arbitrary and bizarre that this entire planet would have been completely upended just because two people had sex, right? You know, in the cool moonlight.
Seems to be happening all over.
It seems to be happening all over. they have this responsibility to stay precisely in line with the way. That's their job, and they were told that a million times. And if they say, "Well, could I deviate by a half a degree? No. Quarter of a degree? No. Tenth of a degree? No." Right? You need to stay precisely on, you know, just like Jesus, you know, was definitely doing. Every time someone tried to get him to do something, it's like, no, that's not the way. Right? You have, you know, when he, you know, and it may just be a temporal issue. My hour has not yet come. Right? I mean, when you consider the way, you have to consider space and time. In your relationship to the Father, there isn't a such thing. And that can get you off on a very false tangent, thinking that space and time don't matter. I can do the right existential thing anytime, in any place. No. We're about to get to that. Okay.
And as the material son and daughter thus communed in the moonlight garden, the voice in the garden reproved them for disobedience. And that voice was none other than my own announcement to the Edenic pair that they had transgressed the garden covenant, that they had disobeyed the instructions of the Melchizedeks, that they had defaulted in the execution of their oaths of trust to the sovereign of the universe.
Okay. Yeah. Of course, we're already starting here. Yeah, that whole voice in the garden thing, you know, as we already know, since our author is Solonia. That's where that end, you know, the so-called voice in the garden is actually not God. It's definitely not the Lord God. It's not Yahweh. Right? It's, you know, it's a seraphim that is part of a Adam and Eve dispensation on every world. And, yeah, there, like I said, see, you know, I wasn't just pulling that out of the poetic air. Yeah, his brown pecks were glistening in the moonlight, hey, literally, okay, as they were pointing out there. Yeah, it was this beautiful, cool autumn night, and yeah. All of the hormonal activity was in full play, as we were talking about last time.
Only natural.
Right, see, and that's the whole thing,
that's
right?
The problem.
It's not natural. Great point. See, just to go back to what I was just saying, there's nothing natural about consciously aligning with the way. Sure, superconsciously by grace, the upper part of you, right, is aligned with the way, coordinates, synchronized with the cosmos. But consciously, you have to take delight in cultivating. If you think that there's something natural about being aligned with, you know, that which is right, that's the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. Right? That there's no effort required. You just are automatically lined up and just, you know, press your foot on the gas pedal. Right? No.
So at this point, you know, that she says that they had transgressed.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, by this point, they hadn't transgressed, because he hadn't done transgress yet. And I'm just wondering,
yep.
when one transgressed, the other transgressed, no matter what, so to speak.
So was she merely speaking fact to them or revealing truth to them?
Okay.
See? So. Remember, we stressed that.
So they're a pair of,
sure, he hasn't actually gotten to having sex with Laeta yet. But, you know, all along, he's been drugged down. Mm-hmm. He's said things that oriented, you know, Eve
right,
downward. Yeah, right, see?
Planted a lot of those seeds that made her, yeah.
They're a system that has lowered their heads down so that you can't see the way anymore, and they got off track.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's an important thing to, we all know we have to challenge ourselves in our, the way we've been programmed to go fact first and then somehow try to get to truth. You know, try to always be thinking, what's the truth of what's being said before you try to analyze the fact of it? The book is first and foremost a revelation of truth, not a disclosure of facts. Okay, let's see. I think the rest is pretty straightforward. You know, they're just, you know, notice how specific she relates this. They have a lot of help, unlike us, you know, in keeping aligned with the way. I mean, there's all these other beings they're working with that, you know, have a higher connection to the cosmos and are speaking directly to them. You know, if push comes to shove, don't think for yourself. Just follow the letter of what the Melchizedek's told you to do. Now, to flip it around, maybe you should give them a little slack. They're from our local system. They know very well how many of their brethren on Gerizim and how many seraphim and whatnot, you know, said to themselves, well, I'm a lowly celestial creature. I mean, I know I don't have a very high vantage point. I mean, I have to just trust that higher Lenonadec sees something that I don't see. And, you know, I've been told since the day I was created that it's like, you know, don't start thinking for yourself too much. Just follow what you're told to do. Right? You know, so Adam and Eve know how all the lemmings went off the cliff, you know, because of that. So, yeah. See, that was part of why, you know, like we talked about last time, how why, you know, Adam to a degree and in full implementation fashion, Eve could get off on this tangent. You know, they've kind of been preconditioned to be a little bit more self-initiating, lest you end up following the falsehoods of, you know, of Satan. Okay. You know, and plus, remember, they've got Caligash and Dalagash, you know, jabbering in their face all the time, you know, trying to lead them astray. And so it's like, okay, no, just, I gotta work on this myself. I can't, you know, think about all these, you know, other thoughts. So, yeah, all these things conspired to get them off track, like we talked about so much last time. All right. Let's see. But, you know, immediately, wow, you know, you've defaulted in the execution of your oaths of trust to the sovereign of the universe. It's like, bam. I mean, she didn't waste any time sticking it to them, right? See, so that incredibly difficult task, see, of when do I trust and when don't I? Definitely shouldn't have trusted Lucifer. I figured that out and I didn't, you know? I mean, this material son and daughter didn't follow Lucifer on Derism. They know they shouldn't trust him, even though they were told to. So it's a very tricky thing to have enough wisdom to know when to trust and when not.
Yeah. Even before you know it.
But trust you must. At some point you must trust. You know, you can't take the easy way out. It's like, well, let me just park my car and just not trust anything. Right? No, God can't steer a parked car. You got to be moving. You've got to trust. So you need the wisdom. You need to somehow find the wisdom to be able to properly trust.
It's kind of like when, I forget whether it was one of the apostles picked up on Lucifer. I mean, not Lucifer, but Judas.
Judas, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Jesus said, you know, not to say anything, but trust him. In other words, to... Mm-hmm. He didn't call him out on it or anything. He knew it was happening, and he just said, but, and so that's kind of in a way similar to, you know, giving that trust to, you know, obviously to a certain point, obviously. Mm-hmm. But you're right. It's difficult sometimes to know when to be.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's a degree to which you know, like Jesus reminded everyone, you know, in an inner life sense, the Jewish leaders are way off track. But until the Most High has removed them, you know, loyally follow them, you must. Revolution is not an option. You know, you must be loyally in the world, but that doesn't mean you have to be of the world. It doesn't mean your inner life has to be defined by the outer life. Right? Like we always talk about, don't drag the garbage in the outer life and replace what was put in there by grace in the upper domain. Right? So there's nothing but scientific dictation, social usage, and religious dogma up there. But still, right? You know, is not revolution. You know, and revolution in general is null. That's rebellion. Let's keep going here.
Eve had consented to participate in the practice of good and evil. Good is the carrying out of the divine plans. Sin is a deliberate transgression of the divine will. Evil is the misadaptation of plans and the maladjustment of techniques, resulting in universe disharmony and planetary confusion.
We don't want to go off in a total discussion of error, evil, sin, and iniquity necessarily right now, but just notice that they did mention the sin issue, you know, stressing the deliberate part. Okay. How, you know, in contrast, you know, what they say there about evil, the first thing you should get from that contrast is, wow, evil could be very sneaky, couldn't it? I mean, just, you know, listen to that. Sounds so intangible. I mean, misadaptation of plans and the maladjustment of techniques is like, oh my goodness gracious. Right. It's you can easily have a limited enough perspective to slip into evil. I mean, basically, evil's a given for creatures like us. There's no way that you can not, in some fashion, you know, have a disrupted relationship to the unity of the cosmos. And hence, you've given evil form in your mind. It doesn't have to be anything that you planned or conscious at all. Okay, you can totally back into wrong. Okay, I mean, you can't back into sin, okay, but you can back into evil.
So you could be both pure in motive and well intend or good or intend mm-hmm. only good mm-hmm. and still do evil.
Genuine, objective evil, you know, right? The way evil is used in the Urantia book as opposed to, well, it has something to do with the taboos, right? Yeah. So, no, I mean, objective evil. So, you know, that's, you know, they're basically, you know, between the lines reminding you this is not a rebellion. There's not sin in play with Adam and Eve. But there's default. There's evil. And with them, that has cataclysmic consequences. They have to stay very precisely synchronized with that unity that's in the wholeness of the cosmos. Remember, a material son or daughter on Gerasim, if they disrupt their relationship to unity, they immediately come unplugged and they're mortal. You know, and that's, of course, technically what just happened here. They'll get to that in a while, some of those details. But, you know, they have a very precise job. They need to stay very methodical and focused. You know, you can't start ad-libbing like they were doing. And again, you see them using that expression, divine plan. We're coming up to a little further elaboration on that along the lines that I've been kind of teasing already. Let's see, anything else there? Oh, just maybe remind you of the prefixes. Misadaptation. So that's wrong adaptation. Right, so there's that wrong word. And mal, that's bad. Right, not good. I see, so there's evil, and, you know, obviously if there's evil, there can't be righteousness, there can't be that three-dimensional fact of synchronization to the cosmos. So there's wrong. All right. Maybe just notice they did bring in a little bit more of what I've been teasing, resulting in universe disharmony. See? That loss of synchronization with the universal harmony, with the cosmos. Okay.
Every time the garden pair had partaken of the fruit of the tree of life, they had been warned by the archangel custodian to refrain from yielding to the suggestions of Caligastia to combine good and evil. They had been thus admonished. Quote, in the day that you commingle good and evil, you shall surely become as the mortals of the realm. You shall surely die.
Okay, so our quote-unquote there, of course, isn't literally totally a quote-unquote out of the third chapter of Genesis. But, you know, they're pointing out that supposedly the Lord God telling them to not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, Okay, there wasn't literally a tree of the knowledge of good and evil like there was literally a tree of life. You know, and they're going to elaborate on that. That whole thing of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, quote unquote, in Genesis, you know, does have ties to actual facts. It's a symbol for a number of facts, that, the details of which were lost over the mythological sequence of time, right, in telling the story. Yep.
So it says every time they ate the tree of life, do you recall them telling us in another part of the book about how often they
had to eat the tree? No, they don't explain. They're very vague on all the physics, right, of this stuff, yeah.
But it sounds to me like it would be...
It's happened multiple. Yeah, obviously it's happened multiple.
Not infrequent.
Right, every time. Yeah, you know, they say so. Yeah, it's not infrequent that they need that booster shot to stay plugged in to the energies that you know that are being pumped into their system.
They had a lot of help.
Yeah.
These guys were.
And you see very directly here that you know, if you want to think of well, was there actually a being that has been turned into the Lord God, quote unquote, in the Genesis story? Yeah, in this case, it's the archangel. You know, they're actually so in the same way that in one hand the Lord God was actually a seraphim, Salonia. You know, here it's actually an archangel. Yep.
Well, I'm curious about this archangel. Is there any mention about the custodian of the Tree of Life anywhere else?
I believe that there is. If I I'd have to go back and look for certain.
Has this custodian been there since Caligasti 100 and the Tree of Life?
We don't know. You know, some of those details. I'll have to go back and look. Got me curious about that detail. You know, the first thought I can have is. You know, it's possibly different when you actually have a Lenanandek present, you know, overseeing the staff. You know, so maybe this only comes into play when you have a material son and daughter as an Adam and Eve. I don't know. You know, maybe it has something to do with the fact that you don't have a Lenanandek, you know, and you know, it's just Adam and Eve here. I'll go back and look and see if there's something else. I think there might be. I have a vague memory of something else along that line.
Plus the circuits were severed.
Yeah, of course, you don't have the circuits or anything. Yeah, yeah. But let's see here. You know, and this whole bit of, you know, you think, well, they're told, don't commingle good and evil. It's like, duh. Right, but you forget, no, you can back into that. Right? You don't, it's not talking about the conscious commingling of good and evil. Yeah. Yeah. You're looking at good and you back into evil and put the two together. Right? You're unwitting. Commingler. Okay. Evil's sneaky. Okay, you gotta be on your guard. You know, it's sad to record, right? So if you take the light in cultivating, so you know, so everyone is backing into evil all the time. And they should be able to recognize some things with their insight.
This was sophisticated as well.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Did we get everything else there? Yep. Let's keep going.
Eve had told Cano of this oft-repeated warning on the fateful occasion of their secret meeting. But Cano, not knowing the import or significance of such admonitions, had assured her that men and women with good motives and true intentions could do no evil, that she should surely not die, but rather live anew in the person of their offspring, who would grow up to bless and stabilize the world.
So, see, the little thing between the lines there is, oh, so that part of the story in Genesis, you know, has some actual fact behind it. It's not the serpent that's telling Eve that, you know, he surely will not die. You know, like the story says, it's Cano that actually, you know, is in the role of quote unquote the serpent there.
Awfully smooth.
Yeah, and again, you notice, see, that because they're Nodites, you know, and very high quality Nodites, you know, both Serapeutatia and Cano, they just lean right into this directioning thing. She's, you know, she would have had to be very, you know, upright to not get sucked into it. You know,
she'd add him in on it.
Okay. I mean, you can see how you just didn't bat an eye there. It's like, you know, and of course that's, you know, that's one of the classic lines in the book that you should remember. Men and women with good motives and true intentions can do no evil. I mean, why is this book in my lap? Why is there an emergency on this planet? Because people with any spiritual consciousness are all ignorant. Think that. Right. And that's why things are in such a desperate state. Nothing's changed in 40,000 years. The exact same immature spiritual consciousness takes you down the exact same path. Notice this is also, you know, a point where they're helping you. Again, we don't use any of these words properly. Right? The revelators are trying to separate motive from intention. You have a spiritual motive and a mindful intention, if you want to properly use those words. So, you know, when you qualify it here, right, since it's a spiritual motive, then you would say the motive is good or bad. And since it's a mindful intention, you would say the intention is true or false. And so you see how Solonia says it precisely that way. You know, and even if you have the requisite insight to take a hold of a good motive instead of a bad motive that you think is a good motive, okay, that doesn't immediately imply a true intention, as Kano is saying here. If you have, if you lack prudence, if you lack wise judgment, if you're insufficient relative to wisdom, you can't translate a good motive into a true intention. Your good motive will be translated into a false intention. Okay, it is a good motive, so there's not evil, but it's a false intention, so there's error. Like Machiavelli to Melchizedek, you know, and that little, you know, Melchizedek can do error, not evil. Right? He gets overruled by the Verondadek, the Most High Observer. Right? He didn't have enough wisdom to properly translate. Right? And so he was, he got overruled. It's like, no, Abraham is going to kill every man, woman, and child as far as the eye can see. Right? And that's what I decree as the Verondadek, you know, ruling in the kingdoms of men. Not what Machiavelli was counseling. All right, so you've got just that basic physics of first you got to get a good motive, not a bad motive, and then you know you've got to properly translate that into a true intention instead of a false intention. Okay, but there's even one additional thing which is the key here. What Kano was thinking and what everyone who basically thinks this same thing today is thinking is that the word good is existential goodness. That if I'm aligned with perfectness, existential goodness, then everything goes as it should. No. You have to align with experiential, evolutionary goodness, perfectingness. Right? It's not enough to just have a proper recognition of the ideal and the existential goodness, the perfectness, you know, that is, you know, what you have your eyes set to. It's like, well, as long as I have my eyes set to perfectness in eternity, you know, everything will just go smoothly between here and there. No, you have to look at what's in front of you. You've got to translate your recognition of perfectness into a proper time-space coordinated perfectingness, which is relative, not absolute. Right? And that's what was not being done here. Right? You know, they keep pointing out no one had lost sight of perfectness. No one had lost sight of the goal. I mean, even Kano and Serpentatia have a proper visualization of the end point that we're striving for. But it's wrong to think that whatever means to that end is a good means. It's not. Okay? And that's where they've gone astray. I mean, give them full benefit of the doubt that there's no basic fault in their rudimentary existential, recognition. And there are, in that existential sense, good motives and true intentions, but that's not relevant. You have to translate that down into space and time. You know, this can't be the kind of truth that's tied to the existential foundation points of beauty and perfectness, that kind of goodness. It can't be that kind of truth, as in truth, beauty, goodness. The existential triplet, right? Yeah, if you look at number 7 on the chart here, it has to be what's in number 2, the block number, field number 2 in the chart. Right? It's that fact, truth, goodness triplet. The kind of truth that's tied to fact in the experiential reality. And that kind of goodness that's there with the fact is perfectingness, not perfectness. Right? You need that kind of a good motive. A perfectingness motive. Okay? And when you don't, you end up doing effectively what Eve did.
Because the facts you're dealing with are not ideal facts.
No.
In any way, shape, or form.
You're not in Havona. Right? Right? Oh. Perfectness is, okay, that's a wonderful recognition, the ceiling of your inner life, but it's of no practical use. You have to figure out perfecting this. And that's a subtle thing. And that's what Jesus is referring to again when he says, my hour is not yet come, okay? I can't just act predicated on perfectness. I have to figure out when and where so that it's good in the sense of perfectingness, that I am synchronizing with the evolutionary process of the whole. I can't just act like I'm an island universe. And my existentialness, everything just has to suck it up and conform. Right? It doesn't work that way. That's self-righteousness.
It kind of harkens to the their counsel about facing facts and adjusting them.
Yeah, to ideals.
It's an experiential adjusting to the existential.
Right. Face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. Right.
I'm thinking, we're a decimal planet, so our evolution has a lot of strange meanderings and so forth.
Curiosities to it, yes.
Well, even if everything had been ideal, I mean, if there hadn't been a
rebellion,
hadn't been a default, would it be possible that our social evolution might still be rather loosey-goosey?
Yes, I mean, the evolution is inherently, on a decimal world, more circuitous. There's fewer straight lines that are drawn by the evolutionary process, yes.
So, the fact that we've had a rebellion and a default just compounds this.
Yeah, yeah.
So that where we are today is in a really...
Yeah, yeah. It's just, it makes it all the more unfortunate when some immature, spiritually conscious person thinks, oh, it's very simple. Just go along this little line here. No, it's never like that. The moment you start thinking there's just some simple little line, you're thinking you're in Havona somewhere. No, you're on this world. And it takes a vast perspective to figure out what the true path is to get properly to the end point in conformity with the whole. You can't just have this one-dimensional vision along some line. You need to see everything in a three-dimensional space. That the wisdom is just so indispensable here, like we've been stressing. Oh, did you have something too?
Okay. Yeah. This kind of reminds me a little bit of, you know, the whole Judas aspect of things in a way. In Adam and Eve, I mean, Eve in this situation, she says, keeps telling Cain, well, we're being told not to do it. You know, she could have said, well, let's go talk to Adam. Let's go talk to somebody else, yeah, see what they think.
But Adam is so busy, you know. Right. And he didn't tell me I'm in charge of this.
My point is, yeah, more that Judas was a little bit the same way.
Yeah.
He didn't discuss things over with his fellow apostles, where they said, you know, both Nathaniel and Thomas may have had the same problems he had, but because they did do that, they ended up, you know, being loyal and so on and so forth.
Yeah, you remember how they stressed with Judas is how unfortunate it was. He just kept getting more and more isolated.
Which is similar in a way,
yeah,
to the situation here. Yes. So to me, the maybe behind the lines lesson here is, you know, to be able to do that. You know, when you're in a situation like this and you have an inkling that maybe you're not doing something right or whatever, to talk it over with others or so on and so forth, to be able to get, you know, who you respect or whatever, to be able to get some insight.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult in general.
It opens up then the ability for the cosmos you're talking about to be able to communicate with you through others and through other things that come into your
exactly
life.
Right. It's difficult enough under normal circumstances for an individual to do it. As we were just stressing on this world, just even more so, you need to find fellow individuals who are seeking to coordinate themselves to the cosmos, and you need to work together, leverage off of one another to help define this. I mean, that's one of the things that's so wonderful about the revelation is you have all of these celestial beings helping you with that. You can work with them to try to leverage your insight up to the point where you can get some, you know, get a hold of the cosmos a little bit more definitively. It's very, very problematic when we isolate ourselves. Yes, very much so. Okay, let's see. We did the whole, good motives, true intentions. If you haven't looked at it in a long time, just whip out, the second and third chapters of Genesis and just read through them again and remind yourself of all these parallels that they touch upon in these stories. And it's just, they're basically using the words, out of the King James Version usually, to construct, so long you hear it, to construct your sentences. The surely die, way of saying it, for instance. All right, but it just, and maybe just one other thing, you mentioned it, the oft-repeated, we saw that so much before, we kept thinking about how many people over how many years had oft-repeated, just all of this stuff, before they left, while they were here. Salonia oft-repeated, the archangel, everyone, Melchizedek's oft-repeated. It should remind you that just because you get to the first mansion world and have all of these helpers oft-repeating to you, doesn't mean you still can't go to iniquity. Right? You still have free will, which means you have no limit on your blinders potential, right? You can close your eyes to anything. And especially if circumstances drag you down, right? And you just kind of get caught up in the minutiae and lose the big picture.
And you can be easily susceptible to others who have that latitude on that world, versus natural world.
Yeah.
You know, just as easily as slick as
that. Whole leveraging off of others that we were just talking about, that can be for good or for ill. Yeah.
But my best friend has told me that this is all cool.
How could 10,000 people be wrong? Okay.
Even though this project of modifying the divine plan had been conceived and executed with entire sincerity and with only the highest motives concerning the welfare of the world, it constituted evil because it represented the wrong way to achieve righteous ends, because it departed from the right way, the divine plan.
Yeah, I've been, I brought that in from the beginning. See, there they're actually using the way, as a synonym way of talking about, what do you mean by the divine plan? There's the right way, period. Like we always stress, everything that's done in Havona is done the right way. Until you can, until you have that perfect consecration of your will, they don't let you in the gates.
Yep.
Right? Perfection of purpose is required to get into Havona. And here you also see, like I was saying, righteous ends. Again, you may have this very proper insight into the ideal, into the end, but there's more to it than that. That's just the initiating step. That doesn't actually guide you as you begin to walk. That just motivates what you're walking towards, not how to walk. Okay, so it's just like they're saying. So there's a wrong way, right, to achieve righteous ends. You can't, and that's fundamentally. You don't get an emergency on a world until you have people that can function in a personal enough way where they actually are recognizing the concept of righteous ends, in a more definitive fashion. And think that's all they need to do. Okay, so I mean, again, Lucifer had very advanced righteous ends in mind. Right, he's not our caricature. He's not this evil being. That is oriented towards some, evil end. No, he knows exactly what what light and life look like, and he's visualizing that definitively in his mind, just like a lot of humans can basically be, fixated on the concept of light and life. But then he concluded that, that's all you need to do. As long as you look at that end, no matter how you walk divinely. No. So that's the key. How do you find the right way, not just the right end?
Well, in this case, the divine plan, when we read the papers on Adam and Eve, normally what they do in a world, that's basically, seems to me, that's pretty standard divine plan. It's pretty standard in every single plan.
Sure, yeah. And even though it wasn't standard here, they had a very precisely laid out plan. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's not like some mystery.
Yeah, it's yeah.
Like for you and me to understand the divine plan, it's not easy, so to speak.
Right. But see that's the whole thing of point. You know, it isn't just talking about their specific example. That's why I'm spending so much time on this, you know, because you know, it's just passing use to us to know, you know, what the specifics were for them. You know, see, but the truth, you know, for them also applies to us, even though the facts for them don't apply to us. You know, eventually, all of us have to do this. We have a level of grace that a material son and daughter, as an Adam and Eve, don't have, right? You know, when we blink wrong, we're not in default and, you know, kicked off the playing field or whatever, right? But still, I mean, you know, all of the basics of this have to be achieved between now and the time you fuse. Yeah. Right? Until you've dotted every I and crossed every T, you don't fuse in this basic regard.
Until
you've met the prerequisites, yeah. Right? You can't, you know, even if you get all the way to first circular, you know, and have that level of cosmic coordination, there's still that final step from first circular to fusion where you have to synchronize, you know, with that nucleus. You know, and until you meet all the prerequisites, until you have the final precise essence of wholeness, you're not going to lock on. You know, and again, that remind you know, as I stress so much, you're not locking onto, and never will you directly touch the existential core of that thought adjuster. You know, what actually was individuated and handed out by the Father, you know, and appeared on Divinington, right? You are synchronizing with that experiential sheath, if you will, right, that's accumulating around that existential core. Right? That's what you're synchronizing with, you know, is the righteousness, that experiential righteousness that's wrapped around that existential core of that adjuster. It's a cosmic nature that you're synchronizing with and that you're gluing onto.
Which they achieve experientially.
Right. Yeah, I mean they've built that up, right, themselves, and you have to build up likewise, and until it's like, it doesn't stick together. You have to have the same quality cosmic character that that adjuster has wrapped around its existential core, or the two cosmic characters don't glue together.
Two boundary conditions that can merge.
Right. Yeah. Right, so again, it's that's what the whole point is to recognize there's a lot more to the story than just awakening to the existence of the Father and how He brought you into existence and okay, now everything is done. Right? You're not innately divine. That's the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto.
Well, even after fusion, you have a long way to go.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, you're just
And then you finally get to the Isle of Paradise and become a resident or a finaliter, and you've got everything yet. Right? That's just now you've gotten to the beginning. Right? I mean, it's just. Yeah.
It's way cool.
Okay. I think we got everything there, didn't we? Yeah. So let's keep going here.
True. Eve had found Cano pleasant to the eyes, and she realized all that her seducer promised by way of, quote, new and increased knowledge of human affairs and quickened understanding of human nature as supplemental to the comprehension of the Adamic nature, unquote.
And quote, unquote, yeah, there's another one of those quote, unquote, quote, unquotes. Okay, but first, you see, there's more of the poetry I was throwing in last time. Yes, he's pleasant to the eyes. His pecs were glistening in the moonlight. It was totally hot. Okay, so And see, and again, they're referring back to the symbolism that's embodied. You know, what is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil literally symbolic of? Not just, you know, the difference between good and evil, but this, you know, it's symbolic of actual things that happened way back then. And see, so you see it, you know, the knowledge, the new increased knowledge, you know, there's the knowledge of good and evil. Yes, that was there. You know, and that contrast between the human nature and the Adamic nature. Yep, she fully discovered that contrast. So, you know, and of course, when all is said and done, that's a positive, right? That's what they have to offer going forward in the universe. Right. You know, is they embody a nature, an experiential nature that only a material son and daughter, the default, can embody. That aspect of filling out supremacy, see, can only be achieved when a material son and daughter default. There isn't any other way in the universe of universes to realize those experiential elements. Some material sons and daughters have to default, or you can't get the grand universe settled in light and life. Just like some beings have to go to iniquity, or you can't get the grand universe settled in light and life. I mean, because for instance, like we always stress, you can't make a supreme adjuster even unless someone goes to iniquity. That's how a supreme adjuster becomes a supreme adjuster, is as the individual uses their free will to go supremely to nothing, the adjuster leverages off that in a reciprocal fashion and goes up to supremity in a positive sense. You know, you could never have a magisterial son or a creator son do an incarnate mission unless someone, some mortal, went to iniquity so that that adjuster could become a supreme adjuster. And of course, you know, actually, those are like very, very experiential adjusters. They probably, you know, had to leverage off of many individuals going to iniquity in order to be the quality it takes to serve on one of those incarnate missions.
Right. Human Jesus had 15 adjuster
previous incarnations. Right. I mean, it's and so, you know, it just, you know, whenever we bring that up, you know, that really throws some fuzzy, idyllic sense of reality out the window, right? Iniquity is indispensable to the evolution of supremacy. It's even indispensable to seventh bestowals of creator sons. So, you know, everything that happens, see, when all is said and done, there are no coincidences, right? The supreme mind is transcendent to all finite facts, including, you know, finite fact going to iniquity or whatever it is, right? It can take every finite fact and use it to its ends. Yeah. So everything all gets coordinated together when all is said and done. You know, there's no parts left over. You know, it's like when you tear apart an engine and put it back together, you know, you get done, there's no, well, I wonder what that part went to, you know, there's just these parts left over after you put the engine back. No, there's no parts that just, you know, hadn't end up having no place, you know, and you're not missing any parts. Everything right down to the last automaton fits in.
But what you're not saying, though, is we as individuals don't have to experience every
No, we don't.
Error that can be made.
Of course not. Yeah, because I'm not the whole. I don't have to encompass the whole, but the whole does encompass everything. You know, that's the point I am getting at. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, like they say, I mean, sin and iniquity aren't required on a world, but evil is. Right, evil is part of the indispensable phenomenon. Right? Is altruism desirable? Is, you know, all those, right? I mean, None of those things can come into existence without the negative contrast. All right. Okay, so yeah. So these, you know, it's another one of those quote-unquotes. You know, it's just reminding you that they're playing off of something in the Bible. Let's see. Yeah, okay, let's keep going.
I talked to the father and mother of the violet race that night in the garden, as became my duty under the sorrowful circumstances. I listened fully to the recital of all that led up to the default of Mother Eve, and gave both of them advice and counsel concerning the immediate situation. Some of this advice they followed, some they disregarded. This conference appears in your records as, quote, the Lord God calling to Adam and Eve in the garden and asking, where are you? Unquote. It was the practice of later generations to attribute everything unusual and extraordinary, whether natural or spiritual, directly to the personal intervention of the gods.
Or the God, if you boil it down to monotheism, you know, and you have Yahweh, for instance. Yeah, everything gets, is the, you know, the infinite micromanager Yahweh. Okay, so the thing that leaps out there is some of this advice they followed, some they disregarded.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking that.
Okay.
That's sad.
Again, see, it's like, well, how can they be that strong-willed still? Didn't this beat them down? That's not the proper way to think about it. And it's a little bit different now, but still, they know that when all is said and done, they've got to figure this out themselves. And that they've been given that duty. It's being put in your hands. The universe respects free will. Right, because the universe knows that what is short-term ill isn't really. Everything becomes goodness in the end. They know that as long as they do their best to be sincere, the Supreme will take what they do. And we'll all, in the end, there are no coincidences. Right? It'll all work out. So those that are, it's not like Saloni is going, well, I'm going to report you to my superiors. And she's not going to respond to that way either. And when all is said and done, we'll look back and it's like, well, if Adam and Eve on this world had followed what Saloni suggested, then it wouldn't have worked. It's like, well, okay, you got to watch out for a posteriori reasoning. The reality is they could have done it many ways and the Supreme would still get everything to light and life, right, when all is said and done. But see, don't overplay that. But nonetheless, you can't help but wonder, what would it have been like here, if they had followed more of that? Would it be better or worse right now? We always want to think, oh, it would have been better. Well, you can't say that for sure. That's not a given. It's not a given at all.
It's really strange because they still know what the divine plan was.
Yeah.
It's a was. It's no longer.
Yeah, now everything is, yeah.
So they're really on their own now.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that was kind of that was one of the things I was just trying to remind you of. See, they know that it's like, okay, this is just, we just need to do what's best. And you'll see when we get later on, the Melchizedeks tell them as much. Now you just Figure it out yourself. In the same way the Melchizedek's are going, well, could we get a little help here? You know, all those years when they were the receivers here, you know, by themselves. And, you know, and they'd ask, you know, they'd send a message up by courier and the message would come back, no, no, you figure it out on your own. Okay. Yeah. All right. I mean, it's all just part of the evolutionary process. All right. So I think we're ready to roll on to the next section here. You have something? Okay.
Yeah. So remember we were reading in the planet from a neighboring planet when they also had a defaulting Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And one wonders what their default might have been. I mean, this default was.
They didn't have nodites there, right? It didn't appear. Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just kind of think about the kinds of ways that they could default. So to speak. I mean, obviously, they probably had a fallen planetary prince there because it was a rebellion world. But you wonder, one wonders, well, I wonder anyway, you know, you see this is how this one happened. You know, what other ways can an Adam and Eve really default, so to speak?
Mm-hmm.
And what you were saying earlier is that probably all the ways they could default are going to be experienced at some time.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that that's...
And until Adam and Eve's default in every way that is possible, you can't get the grand universe settled in light life. So, again, it's just, that's the reality.
You have to be tested in every possible way.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you have to flesh out all finite possibilities. Especially here, you know, when you think about what I remind you of, where they tell you, okay, I mean, sin and iniquity aren't required, but evil is. I mean, we're just talking about evil here, see? So, I mean, it's not just Adam and Eve's and all the ways that they could go astray, but all of us, you know, have to embody a certain flavor of evil, a certain place and time. You know, I mean, all that has to be fleshed out because someone is, in some way, in the universe of universes, is going to respond positively to your negative stimulus when you embody evil, right? And something is going to come into existence that only could come into existence because you embodied evil then and there. I mean, it's all used to good. That's why, you know, it tells you, as long as you're being sincere, that which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. Okay, this all works out. You know, just chill out a bit, people. You know, be more trusting. Just keep going, trying to do your best, and you know, don't look in the rearview mirror all the time, you know, and regretting the past. All right, let's see what else we've got here.
Section 5, the repercussions of default. Eve's disillusionment was truly pathetic. Adam discerned the whole predicament, and while heartbroken and dejected, entertained only pity and sympathy for his erring mate.
Okay, so just that that little bit that they're putting up front, the suffering. Notice you have pathos there, you know, pathetic, sympathy, the suffering. Just remind yourself of a key thing. In order to suffer, you have to have an objective vantage point, you know, from which you can look down on your feelings. They've lifted themselves back up again, you know, to a degree. So it's like, you know, I mean, when you've heard me talk about this before, I think, when you think about, animals have feelings, but they can't suffer because they have no objective vantage point above their feelings to reflect upon those feelings and suffer in the midst of them, right? I mean, the literalness of the word suffer, right? It means literally to bear under. The S-U-F there is, I mean, it's from S-U-B. It's turned into an F because it's, you know, a prefix in front of an F. I mean, it literally means bear under. I mean, see, until you can get up so that there's an under, you can't literally be what that word is describing. You know, you're dealing with what, you know, is under, right? And how it's bearing down on you, right? See, it's truly pathetic. Right? There's just this, you know, there's this objective suffering going on, not just merely subjective feeling. And you know, and even notice, you know, they're always so precise with this when they say about Adam, you know, pity and sympathy. Okay, the foundation one, the second word is sympathy, right? So the immediacy of the suffering together, right? So an eye level with Eve, right? There's that mutual suffering, but then upon that foundation, you know, pity, right? Where there's also a degree to which, you know, he's above looking down. Okay. You know, so it's just fun to notice how precisely, you know, they construct these sentences, you know, especially those pairs, you know, which is the foundation word and which is, you know, which word is built upon that foundation.
I love the word heartbroken.
Yeah, and see, and again, until you get up in the heart again, you can't be heartbroken. Right, the upper domain in the hourglass analogy. So again, like I was stressing, see, there's that objective space. I mean, this is being. There's feelings that being produced that are predicated on objective clarity. Right? I mean, there's a recognition, objective recognition, in the upper domain, of how the relationship to the unity in the cosmos has been broken. Heart broken.
So it's almost like a more exquisite sorrow.
Yeah. 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 And so, yeah, I mean, obviously there's degrees of sorrow. But like I was stressing, even the minimal sorrow, technically, if you're going to use that word properly, that implies that, yeah, I mean, you know, sorrow and suffering, that implies that there is, you know, an objectivity. You know, don't anthropomorphize. I mean, yeah, obviously an animal has feelings, but it doesn't suffer. It has no reflective relationship to its feelings. You know, it doesn't even know, it's not even aware of its feelings. It just feels.
Right? Yeah. This is quite different than a typical man-wife. Or once done something wrong. The amount of recrimination naturally take place. Yeah. That's not here.
Yeah, I mean, and again, they're so understanding of each other's limitations. They know that neither of them can be that hard on each other. They know how much they need each other, that, you know, they're just two halves of one whole. And you can't really, you know, hold any long-term, you know, negative feeling. It's just a given. It's like, well, okay. You know, the vicissitudes of this world got the two halves going off, and okay. It's just inevitable. A half is never a whole. All right. Let's keep going.
It was in the despair of the realization of failure that Adam, the day after Eve's misstep, sought out Leota, the brilliant Nodite woman who was head of the Western schools of the garden, and with premeditation committed the folly of Eve. But do not misunderstand. Adam was not beguiled. He knew exactly what he was about. He deliberately chose to share the fate of Eve. He loved his mate with a supermortal affection, and the thought of the possibility of a lonely vigil on your rancho without her was more than he could endure.
Even with all of his objective abilities, right, the word endure there, even then, you know, but you just have to chuckle. It's like, wow, okay, so the school teacher. it's kind of a cliche here or something, isn't there?
he had to know what that was going to do to her, though.
Yeah, and of course, we all know that in this case, it's really harsh. I mean, you know, we chuckle about, you know, how they were dumping their sewage into the drinking water of the Nodite village, you know, outside the wall. Okay, that's one thing. Okay, you know, he knows he's condemning Leota to death to do this. He knows she can't survive the discontinuity, you know, between his nature and her nature. Yeah. Right? That's the whole point of downstepping one more notch to the children, so that, you know, there is not that break between the biologic natures, and they meet, you know, on the same level. And he knows this is going to introduce a stress into her biologic system that she won't be able to endure, and she's going to die in childbirth. It's a very harsh thing to do.
Does it say she dies in childbirth somewhere?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
She kind of begs the question.
And he knows it.
why not seek out a real non-issue female.
You know, no,
he's not a teacher.
Right, you know. I don't know. It's just like, wow, you know, it's like
all things being equal.
Yeah, it's just
beyond that.
Yeah.
You know, you brought this up a couple of classes ago about the relationship between Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And that had been so tight for so long, you know, the whole truth. The thing that's sad to me, or not sad to me, or sort of interesting is that he didn't want to serve, be there without her.
Yeah.
So I don't think he was really thinking, you know, rationally.
Think it through.
You know, I don't know how many people in here have been divorced or gone through something traumatic in a relationship or not, but you don't think rationally in the midst of something like that happening, oftentimes.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not saying it's an excuse for him, but.
Yeah. There's that.
Brought up
and
how close they are.
Yeah, right. There's that, and then there's just this, like, well, okay. I mean, you know, you have to think about how they think about mortality. I mean, you know, they live for millions of years on a world normally, you know, and how many generations live and die? Everyone lives and dies, you know. I mean, they have a very, death is irrelevant, basically, you know, to a degree. So. You know, but you don't want to think, you know, you don't want to make him too cold-hearted. I mean, he's having to face this very difficult decision. It's like, you know, it's just, that's the way it's going to have to be. Definitely know he's it's premeditated, right? But they point out, in this case, you don't have, and her skin was so silky. Yeah. Okay, you didn't have that going on. I can't have with Kano.
Not much of a fight.
Yeah, probably not. Little did she know what she was, signing up for, but.
So why was he forgiven as well as her if he was doing this more? In a premeditated way.
Again, like I said, I mean, what they're being judged about is not these issues like this. He's just following suit. That's not part of the divine plan. For them to be mating directly. See, and remember, don't forget, on some worlds, the plan for that world is for the Adam and Eve to mate directly.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not doing something that's totally out of bounds. On some worlds, the Adam and Eve do mate directly. You know, you can imagine if the people of those worlds are a closer fit, you know, there isn't so much downstepping involved. Right, so, I mean, again, they're not just, doing something totally radical out in left field. Let's keep going here.
When they learned what had happened to Eve, the infuriated inhabitants of the garden became unmanageable. They declared war on the nearby Nodite settlement. They swept out through the gates of Eden and down upon these unprepared people, utterly destroying them. Not a man, woman, or child was spared. And Cano, the father of Cain, yet unborn, also perished.
And did Adam and Eve stop them? Now you could say, well, how would they have stopped them? Well, they did wield a lot of authority, but, you know, unmanageable, well, okay, you know, yes and no. Again, can't, you know, so you can see how they know that this is going to have all kinds of consequences, you know, what's just happened. I mean, not just in the immediate generations, but still today, right? They were immediately projecting forward 40,000 years to us living right now and the things that we would suffer, right? That some of us are going to die of diseases that we never would have died of. And, you know, they would be horrendous, long, drawn-out deaths. And all of that is because of what they did. You know, it's not just Laodicea and the villagers nearby. And, I mean, they know how much death and destruction this is, you know, going to reap for thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
So she must have survived this invasion to only to perish in childbirth.
Well, no, I mean, no, she's in the garden.
She's in the garden.
Remember, she's in the garden. You know, you got a bunch of these, you know, they're actually living in the garden. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Upon the realization of what had happened, Sarepta was overcome with consternation and beside himself with fear and remorse. The next day, he drowned himself in the great river.
So it's all going very sadly here. You know, one thing, you know, speaking about the Old Testament, you know, all the times that you have stories of, you know, every man, woman, and child was killed. You can see that was the tradition way, way, way back. It's not just in the Old Testament. And then the great river, I suspect that they mean there is the Euphrates, you know, because remember, you know, once you get away from the immediate river that's coming out of the garden, you're often, you know, wherever Sarepta is to the north some, I suspect that must be the Euphrates that they're talking about there.
It's not easy to drown yourself either.
No.
I was thinking that, actually.
But, you know, you tie a few rocks to your body and then jump in.
It's the millstone technique.
Yes. So we've got the, you know, these two individuals that that end up being symbolized as the quote-unquote snake in the story. You know, some of the things are actually tied back to Sarepta, and some of the things are tied back to Cana. You know, and so you think about the, you know, that story and how, yeah, both of them came to a very sad end here. All right, keep going.
The children of Adam sought to comfort their distracted mother while their father wandered in solitude for 30 days. At the end of that time, judgment asserted itself, and Adam returned to his home and began to plan for their future course of action.
Wandered in solitude, a direction that appears to have lost its place. Can't stop being direction. It is placeless.
Yeah.
Just wandering. And I'm pretty sure what they're referring to there. At the end of that time, judgment asserted itself. They tell you later on, we won't get to it tonight, but they tell you later on that they were aware when their adjusters arrived. Right, the judgment is you're now mortal, right? I mean, remember how we read, you know, you shall surely become as the mortals of the realm, right? I mean, that's, you know, the judgment, quote unquote, we're talking about here is being, you know, they definitely knew that they were mortal when they experienced an adjuster arrive. It's like, okay. So
this judgment, it's not just something that's going on in the inner life. It must be, well, no, it can't be.
It has to come from you. Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. See, I mean, you know, just, I mean, but the way they're talking about there, you know, they're, you know, and you think about, they explain, you know, he has definite, you know, remorse about all this. You know, so that sincere remorse combined with some time here and an adjuster came. You know, so at that point he, okay, you know, he had kind of a whole new sense of things, vision of things, if you will, right, within, and, you know, he returned home and began to plan for their future course of action, right?
Him considering living without his mate, he had to put himself in her status to avoid that, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what he's deciding. It's like, this is just, you know, he just couldn't imagine how he could somehow make up for her complimentary nature. You know, it's like I can imagine it theoretically, but he just couldn't figure out, okay, practically, I just can't see how this is going to work. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not like a normal world.
He can't take up with another
woman. Well, I mean, you know, he can't sort of plug into a support system they would have on a normal world. You know, you can imagine if you didn't have a rebellion and an Adam and Eve came and they, you know, and one of them defaulted, you know, maybe one of them would, you know, the other would decide that, okay, I think maybe with the help of, you know, the prince and staff and everyone, okay, I can make it through this.
And that's probably happened.
Yeah, and it's probably happened, see? Yeah.
Michael functioned as a material son.
Yeah.
But he is different
in
the sense that he embodies... Does he not embody?
Yeah, well, plus he wasn't, you know, remember, he was not literally doing the biologic uplifter role and stuff, you know, yeah. But, okay, so anyway, I'm pretty sure that's what they're referring to there between the lines is him, you know, why he would turn around is that, you know, he was aware that his adjuster arrived.
The consequences of the follies of misguided parents are so often shared by their innocent children. The upright and noble sons and daughters of Adam and Eve were overwhelmed by the inexplicable sorrow of the unbelievable tragedy which had been so suddenly and so ruthlessly thrust upon them. Not in 50 years did the older of these children recover from the sorrow and sadness of those tragic days, especially the terror of that period of 30 days during which their father was absent from home while their distracted mother was in complete ignorance of his whereabouts or fate.
Okay, besides the issues with the children, this incredible scarred for life, you know, as it were, impact on them, and just think about, you know, like they're pointing out, I mean, the upright and noble sons and daughters, I mean, none of them had even remotely entertained going off on some tangent. Didn't matter. Mom and Dad did, and so, you know, we're all hosed. But that final thing, complete ignorance of his whereabouts or fate, remember that the instant that they gave badness form in their mind, you know, the instant that there's evil, they're disrupted, and they don't have that mindful communication ability. Right. So even if he's closer than 50 miles, it doesn't matter. Right. They can't. They're severed from that. That ability to, you know, to pick up on the mind oscillations in the mind energy system between them. Right, so it just, boom. I mean, see, that's when, you know, Adam recognized that something was wrong, right? Right, so, you know, he's reaching out mindily and, right, hello. Nothing, no response.
Flatline.
Yep. So, so that's what's going on there. Yeah, because I mean, if you go back and look, they tell you that instantly, you know, that's disrupted. There's no delay of 30 days or something like that or whatever, you know, instantly. So,
And those same 30 days were as long years of sorrow and suffering to Eve. Never did this noble soul fully recover from the effects of that excruciating period of mental suffering and spiritual sorrow. No feature of their subsequent deprivations and material hardships ever began to compare in Eve's memory with those terrible days and awful nights of loneliness and unbearable uncertainty. She learned of the rash act of Serapeutatia and did not know whether her mate had in sorrow destroyed himself or had been removed from the world in retribution for her misstep. And when Adam returned, Eve experienced a satisfaction of joy and gratitude that never was effaced by their long and difficult life partnership of toiling service.
See, there's only one way for that experience to happen, right? You know, and they make it all the way to the Isle of Paradise and become finaliters, and they still embody those experiences, even though they've left male and female long behind, like all of us, right? See, again, just see it in that big context. That those contrasting experience, you know, the depth of both of those experiences just in and of themselves, and then the contrast between the two, there's only one way that that can come into experiential existence, right? And they drew that that number, right?
Yeah.
They're the ones that are forever going to embody that part of experience. Then the other fun thing there, again, is, you know, there's a number of where they're helping you with how the relators are suggesting a more precise use of the English language. Notice, the previous paragraph, they threw in, you know, sorrow. You know, we had suffering already in play. But here they go, mental suffering and spiritual sorrow. I see. So they're trying to get you to think about... there's an essence in those two words that you is kind of there in the dictionary that you can tease apart more precisely. And see, and think about that word sorrow as describing directly what you have as that observer from that objective vantage point. And then like I was pointing out with the word suffering, see that that's, you know, what you're bearing below. Right? See, so the mind below the spirit objective point. Right? So they're, you know, using those. And notice when they say them that way, mental suffering and spiritual sorrow, it's in a top-down mode, right? The foundation one is the sorrow, right? And then the suffering is upon that foundation. So it's a top-down vantage point that they're putting the order of the two of them even, see? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... that's, even more so that only a human can suffer, not an animal, no matter how fancy the animal. Even more so, only a human can have experience sorrow.
Yeah.
Right? So you mean to tell me that when they talk about putting down my dog, they're suffering, they're really not suffering?
They're feeling lots of pain and whatnot, but they're not... technically suffering. You might be suffering because you empathically identify with those feelings, right? You're suffering, but they're not suffering. Right? But they are feeling pain, lots of pain, but they're not suffering. See, it's just, again, to work on abstracting your human quality from your animal foundation. Feelings, yes, but feel that difference. It's suffering is more. Suffering is the sensation, the negative sensation, plus a reflective engagement of it. Right? And that suffering is a superadditive consequence of the relationship between the sensation and the reflection. Right? It's a higher fact. You know, and then they're pointing out that sort of the ceiling of that, fully up there, is what the word sorrow should apply to. You know, so that sorrow is a spiritual word precisely, like pride. Pride is a spirit word. Okay? Not just a mental word. You know, so it has to do with, you know, getting up there in your relationship to unity, and, you know, describing the nature there, the tensions there, you know, what have you.
Long-suffering, one of those fruits of the Spirit?
Yeah, there's, you know, those New Testament, yeah, single words, fruits of the Spirit. Yeah, there's long-suffering, yep. Yeah. Okay, let's see, anything else there? I mean, other than just, you know, again, if you read back through that, notice, you know, how they're stressing that, how those experiences stood out relative to anything else. And like I said, the point is, see, there's only one way that that deep a contrast can be engaged and incorporated, you know, the positive fruits of it. You know, if an Adam and Eve didn't default, and if the Adam didn't go wandering, you know, and I mean, yeah, you know, only then can you have that big of a tension that you can take a hold of, you know, and maybe not in the short term, but eventually it will power great things, right? I mean, you know, somewhere in their ascension career, right, they'll eventually fully encompass that if they don't already, and that differential will power us, you know, something that no other beings in the universe, you know, possess. Right, they'll be able to do something, you know, that a divine counselor or whatever can't do, because they embody that internalization of the tension of that kind of tension in the universal absolute. Right, they've taken that potential, and, you know, and have actualized and realized it, encompassed with their personality, and it now powers something in what they can offer others.
So in a very, very small way, do each one of us have that, what is it, potential? Or?
Yeah, each one of us needs to find the courage and the objectivity to, instead of repelling from the tensions that we meet in life, but to meet them face on and wrap your arms around them, encompass those, right? I mean, you're experiencing the universal absolute that we all live within, and your job is to take a hold of that potential, encompass it, and actualize it, and realize it, and you power it, use it to good. Pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution. That's that differential is what powers the progress of evolution. If there wasn't that tension, you know, if you didn't stick your finger in the voltage and feel that pain and suffering, you know, if that voltage wasn't there, you'd have a dead battery, nothing would be moving. There would be no evolution, right? That's what's powering the movement. You know, that's the whole point, is that negative environment exists. Your job is to respond positively to that negative stimulus, to be a human, to do something with it. And sometimes it may take a very long time. As you can tell, probably took Eve a very long time. I mean, Eve is now part of the 420 counselors, and like I said, you know, she may have gotten to the point where she actually has gotten on top of that experience, and she's now its master, the masters of its potential, rather than being a helpless victim of it. Right? But, you know, even if she hasn't already, eventually she definitely will.
And she's got a TA now.
And she has a thought adjuster. It helps a lot, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Yeah, let's keep going here.
Time passed, and Adam was not certain of the nature of their offense until 70 days after the default of Eve, when the Melchizedek receivers returned to Urantia and assumed jurisdiction over world affairs. And then he knew they had failed.
Yeah, getting the adjusters was kind of a hint. It's like, well, okay, but maybe we're supposed to just go on, you know, with our adjusters, maybe the adjusters are enough that now we can make something positive out of this. And no, the kids and ex-receivers show up again. It's like, okay, we blew it, totally blew it.
And they were only 70 days from the event.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I was just going to bring that up. See, that's where, yeah, that's where, like I said, when you know, when you read this and you go, how relatively short after, you know, it was done, the Melchizedeks arrive. Then you can think back. It's like, now, how long were they planning that? Oh, yeah, about 5 years, right? So, again, see, Gerasim must be somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 light years away. It must take about 5 years to get here by seraphic transport. You know, and the fact they told you it was a little more than 5 years, like, well, okay, they were watching for a while. Initially, you're not sure, you know, since she's starting to interact with Serapeutatia, but it didn't take long. It's like, okay, the writing's on the wall. They packed their bags, got in the transport Seraphim, did the 5 year journey, and ta-da, 70 days after they show up. Yeah.
Everybody's like, you guys just got back and you're back there again?
Something's up. Yeah. Yeah. It didn't take long. Yeah, so that's how you wrap back around and get really suspicious. Like, okay, that's two times now. Once with the rebellion and once with the default. That there's been a 5 year gap that they've mentioned. Yeah. Pretty suspicious that it's a 5 year trip by transport Seraphim between here in Gerasim.
But still more trouble was brewing. The news of the annihilation of the Nadite settlement near Eden was not slow in reaching the home tribes of Serapeutatia to the north. And presently a great host was assembling to march on the garden. And this was the beginning of a long and bitter warfare between the Adamites and the Nadites, for these hostilities kept up long after Adam and his followers emigrated to the second garden in the Euphrates Valley. There was intense and lasting, quote, enmity between that man and the woman, between his seed and her seed, unquote.
That's another quote-unquote. I think probably everyone's familiar with that passage. And again, in the story in Genesis, it's the serpent, right, and Eve. You know, that there's this long-lasting tension between his seed, the serpent, and her seed. They're saying, no, obviously not the serpent, but right, Serapeutatia. So, you know, that's why they mentioned him up there. And they said, that man, okay, that's Serapeutatia, mm-hmm. Right? And that, and the woman, that's Eve, of course. Right? And so there's the Nadites and the Adamites. That's what the story in Genesis is hearkening back to, is that tension between the two of them. And so, you know, so when you finally get done, it's like, well, that's pretty cool. Even though these are very indirect, nonetheless, you know, the basic essence of what happened is symbolically represented in the Genesis story. And you just need to take it out of the simplistic kind of childlike, you know, facts of the story that's in the Bible. All right, so, and just before we wrap up, they notice that even after they got to the second garden, you know, so that reminds you, when we read forward, you know, they're immediately going to have some very fortified, wherever the heck they're going to go, they're thinking, okay, we've got to have something that's defensible and fortifiable, because just because we leave the first garden, the Nadites are going to go, okay, well, we'll just forget about it. No, you know, not only will they not forget about it, but there's Nadites all over that region, right? This is just the, you know, the Western Syrian Nadites.
Yeah.
Word is going to spread. So, that's the looming thing. You know, Adam is wrestling with, like, where are we going to go, and how are we going to somehow get a situation, you know, that where we can defend ourselves against just, you know, what did they say there? A great host was assembling, right, yeah, to march. Yeah.
Not just Gibbons.
Yeah. So, Yeah, it, you know, you can just imagine how difficult it is for either of them to get any sleep. I mean, just the gears would be just turning, trying to somehow think this out. And they know they have almost no time. I mean, they got to leave immediately, and they've got to get somewhere relatively quickly, and they've got to somehow get established relatively quickly. And this is a huge logistics thing that they're facing. They're going to need all of the objectivity that their adjusters can foster in their minds. See, you may recall, and they're talking about Cain, about how just how significant it was to have an adjuster back in those days. You just the objectivity solidifying that the adjuster brought to people. You know, because there's a lot of people that don't have adjusters. You know, so you really stood out. You know, you could outsmart logistically in military situations and stuff the run-of-the-mill individual because you had that greater solidification of clarity that the adjuster was bringing to their minds. They're going to need every bit of it they can get their hands on.
Planning for the prior days that used to be miserable. Now it looks...
Yeah.
Now, you just go back.
Now it looks paradisiacal, yeah. Yes. And we call, we use Eden as a synonym for paradise. Yeah. Okay, well, the sadness is, you know, not done yet. You know, as we start up next time, we read that next section. You know, the very, very harsh facts are, you know, the hammer hasn't come down yet totally, so... Well, you know, everyone take a deep breath and prepare yourself for next week. We've got more to come here. But I hope people, you know, come away with, you know, yet another example of how what they're telling you in the Revelation is trying to encourage this recognition of your other parent. You have two parents. Right, the fifth epical revelation, it's telling you for the first time you have two parents, and they're both important. You have one parent for eternity and one parent for time. You have one parent in eternity so you can plant your feet there, and one parent in time so your hands can work there. And you need to be synchronized with both if you're going to really accomplish something, if you're going to do something meaningful with your life. You can't just have the ideal from the Father. You've got to be able to find the wisdom to translate it into an effective idea, and you can't get that from the Father. You can only get that from your other parent, taking delight in cultivating. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.